Good to see all of you this morning. If you would please open your Bibles to 2 Samuel chapter 18. 2 Samuel chapter 18. In our study this morning, we want to continue to talk about King David and his relationship to the people of God, the difficulties that existed during his reign, of course, some of the mistakes that he made, and the consequences that were imposed as a result of his decisions. In 2 Samuel, the portion of the text that we're studying has to do with Absalom's rebellion, his efforts to take over the kingdom or take away the kingdom from his father David. We know that he has employed the help or counsel of Ahithophel, who had been the counselor of King David. David called upon God that he might bring to foolishness the counsel of Ahithophel. In chapter 15, we know that King David has sent one of his best friends, Hushai, to be the spy on his behalf among those of Absalom's company. And, of course, when the time comes for the battle to ensue, Ahithophel gives his counsel. And what was the counsel of Ahithophel? David? All right, go kill the king. That's what his desire was, kill David. And he thought then perhaps that would unite the kingdom if he didn't kill anybody else, he'd just bring them all back. Well, Hushai took issue with that. And what was Hushai's counsel? Randy?
Hushai's counsel was that they should gather together the entire army, all the fighting men in the entire country.
All right. All right. And what was his reasoning about that? What would be the element in his equation that was not in Ahithophel's counsel?
Well, several. One was Absalom would go to war.
Yes.
Because the other, Ahithophel's plan didn't include Absalom going to war.
All right.
It included him going Ahithophel leading, I forgot how many, 200,000.
Well, 12,000
men.
All right, good. And then another element was, in order to gather an army from Dan to Beersheba, this is going to take time. And time for Hushai to do what?
Well, time to let David flee and do what he needs to do to get his act together.
All right, time to inform David so that he can flee and make preparation. David then is instructed by the priest that Hushai sends to David to flee on beyond the Jordan, not to remain there, which he does, and he goes up to Mahanaim, and the battle then takes place near Mahanaim. And when the battle ensues, what instruction, specific instruction, does David give to his captains, Joab, Abishai, and Hittai? All right, to deal gently with the young man Absalom, his son. Well, when the battle ensues, what happens to Absalom? John?
His hair caught up in a tree, things there, and then Joab comes and throws some spears against the
Arabs. All right, so he throws his darts through them, and the armor bearer, the young men, they finish him off, and so he's dead, and the war is over. Joab blows the trumpet, and the people of David's army go home. Now, by way of contrast, as far as a memorial is concerned, what was it that Absalom had set up in his own memory, then, as he didn't have any heirs? He set up a monument of stone, and what is it that Joab and his army do in memory of Absalom? We might put that word in quotation marks. What does he do with him? His body. He put him in a pit, yes, and raised over him a great heap of stones. So that's the end of Absalom. We note that runners go back, and the Cushite in particular bears the specific tidings to David that his son Absalom is dead. And how joy does David respond to these tidings? To say the least. If you'll note in verse 33, he's dead. And you'll notice in verse 33 that he wept sore. And he said, and note the words, "O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son." His heart is broken. Now here is his enemy. Now in our concluding remarks of our class Wednesday night, we talked about how that this really didn't have to be so. What did all this stem from? What caused all this? Sin. Whose sin? David's sin. That's right. You remember he went into the wife of Uriah the Hittite, Bathsheba, and committed adultery with her, wound up having her husband murdered, and trying to conceal the sin that he committed. And now we find that as a consequence of his sin, Nathan has told him in chapter 12 that bad things are going to come out of your house. And we know that indeed that was so. Amnon, his son, raped Tamar, his sister. And then Absalom killed Amnon. And now Absalom has led in a rebellion, attempting to take the kingdom from David. And now Absalom, his son, is dead. Now, that's where I want to begin our study this morning, as we think about the consequence and the troubles in David's house. Now, in 2 Samuel chapter 19, 2 Samuel chapter 19, before we talk about the restoration of David to the throne in the city of Jerusalem. Question, Bruce? All right, everybody would know what's happening with David as a result. That's right. Now, David's grief over Absalom is so severe. Yes, Joy?
We also see in this the impartiality of God. It reminds me of the scripture that says, God's no respecter of persons. When David did this, God did not give David some kind of special treatment, right?
That's right.
He punished him as he would anybody else for David's sin. So David did not get some kind of free pass because he had this special relationship with God. When he sinned in this way, God dealt with him severely.
Well, we know that the consequence of adultery was he was to be killed. Now, David was not killed. We talked about that. But yes, consequences ensued upon him for the rest of his house. Death might be more desirable. But we know that in this instance, the consequences existed for the rest of his life. He was involved in battle for the rest of his days. To some degree with the Philistines, over and over with the Philistines. We'll talk about them more in the next few chapters. But then, of course, the problems within his house was the result of the sin that he committed. Now, David's grief over the death of Absalom was so severe. What was the feared consequence of that by Joab? Ken? What was it that Joab was concerned about?
He might, because he was involved with all that, right?
Well, that's right. Joab's concern was that if you're going to grieve so deeply over Absalom, who, though he is your son, is also your enemy, if you're going to grieve so deeply over his death, maybe you would rather than that those who fought for you had been killed by Absalom. Now, if you take a position like that, what's going to happen to your following? David's the king, and he's grieving over the death of his enemy. Let's forget for the moment that his enemy was his son. But he's grieving over the death of his enemy. What's going to happen to the loyalty of his army?
Because Absalom was trying to kill him, therefore he was an enemy.
Yes.
David.
Yes. And look, if you will, in verse 4, for example. It says, "And the king," chapter 19, verse 4, "and the king covered his face, and the king cried with a loud voice, 'O my son Absalom, O Absalom, my son, my son.'" You see, the grief is ongoing for Absalom by David. And in verse 5, Joab came into the house of the king and said unto him, "Thou hast shamed this day the faces of all thy servants who this day have saved thy life, and the lives of thy sons and of thy daughters, and the lives of thy wives, and the lives of thy concubines, in that thou lovest them that hate thee, and hatest them that love thee. For thou hast declared this day that princes and servants are naught unto thee. For this day I perceive that if Absalom had lived, and all we had died this day, then it had pleased thee well." It would be hard to be loyal to a fella who would rather that you die, wouldn't it? And so this is Joab's concern. What does David do in response to what Joab has to say? And before we answer that, I want to conclude this next verse, verse 7. He says, "Now therefore arise, go forth, and speak comfortably unto thy servants, for I swear by Jehovah, if thou go not forth, there will not tarry a man with thee this night, and that will be worse unto thee than all the evil that hath befallen thee from thy youth until now." What does Joab want David to understand? If you continue this kind of behavior, all right, I want to underscore in your thinking that expression, "this night." Do you see that the admonition of Joab to David is urgent? You've got to change this now. Because if you don't, you'll lose the loyalty of your people. And if you lose the loyalty of your people, then what's happened to you so far will seem as nothing.
The fact is, he'd already lost the loyalty. Absalom. So now Absalom is dead, and they're kingless until David comes back.
Okay. Well, Absalom's efforts has gained the loyalty of the people, not necessarily through, I don't believe, David's doing, but what we do see is that Absalom is granting favors to, he's a politician.
To he's able to raise up a pretty good sized army.
Very much so. Very much so. And Absalom, I'm sorry, Joab, says you've got to take care of that and do it now. Because if it goes beyond this night, here's what's going to happen. And you've got to take care of this. It has an urgency attached to it. Well, then the king arose, verse 8, and sat in the gate, and they told unto all the people, saying, "Behold, the king is sitting in the gate," and all the people came before the king. Now Israel had fled, every man to his tent. And all the people were at strife throughout all the tribes of Israel. Now, Randy brought up an interesting point about some division that exists. We've got those who were the followers of Absalom, and we've got those who are the followers of David. And I find it ironic, in some respects, interesting to say the least, that when we get to the time of David's son, of course, Solomon sat on the throne. His son, Rehoboam, sat on the throne. And it was Rehoboam, we'll talk about this, who through his foolish judgment wound up dividing the kingdom. And they bring back Jeroboam from Egypt to become their king. And the kingdom divides from that point to what we know as Israel and Judah. Do you see that festering here?
And actually, this whole time, all the people that Absalom recruited, basically, they are lumped under the term Israel.
Yes.
Israel against Judah already.
Yes. So we've got a sore that's festering among the people of God during the days of David. And of course, we know that David reigned for 40 years. Solomon, his son, reigned for 40 years. And then during the reign of Rehoboam was the time when the kingdom actually split or divided. But you see that beginning here during the time of David. In verse 9 it says, "And all the people were at strife throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, The king delivered us out of the hand of our enemies, and he saved us out of the hand of the Philistines, and now he has fled out of the land from Absalom. And Absalom, whom we appointed over us, is dead in battle. Now therefore, why speak ye not a word of bringing the king back?" Where does this generate? Among the tribes of Israel. Now, you pointed out, we've got this division that is a characteristic of what appears to be the northern 10 tribes, and we'll notice that in verse 43 of chapter 19. But as you continue through this particular context, this debate about bringing the king back, I find fascinating. It originates among those of Israel, you'll see in verse 9. But then as you continue the thought in verse 15, it says, "So the king returned and came to the Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal to go to meet the king, to bring the king over the Jordan." What happened to Israel and their brilliant idea? Let's go get the king back and appoint him to be our king. Judah goes to meet him at the Jordan when he comes back, and that becomes a sore spot for Israel, does it not? We're going to have to jump ahead and then come back, but if you'll look at verse 40, it says, "So the king went over to Gilgal," we'll comment on that as well, "and Chimham went over with him, and all the people of Judah brought the king over, and also half the people of Israel. And behold, all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, 'Why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen thee away and brought the house and his household over the Jordan and all David's men with him?' And all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, 'Because the king is near of kin to us. Wherefore then are ye angry for this matter? Have we eaten at all at the king's cost, or hath he given us any gift?' And the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, 'We have 10 parts in the king, and we have also more right in David than ye. Why then did ye despise us, that our advice should not be first had in bringing back our king?' And the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel." We need to explain that. What's going on between the men of Judah and the men of Israel?
Having a tug of war.
Well, the argument that those of Judah make is, "We're closer kin to David than you are. David is of the tribe of Judah. So it's our place to go and bring him back." What argument do the men of Israel make? Alright, there's more of us than there are of you. And so our relationship to the king is greater because we represent 10 tribes. Now, that's an argument, isn't it? And what you want to note in that is we've got an argument that ultimately results in the division, a very clear division, in the thinking of those identified as Israel versus those identified as Judah. Now, holding that thought in mind, let's back up just a little bit in the text of chapter 19. Chapter 19. Go back, if you will, to verse 16. Chapter 19, verse 16. We read about Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, who was of Bahurim. He hasted, it says, and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. Now we need to identify Shimei. Who is he?
He's the guy that was thrown off the dais when David left the city.
He was. We've got Absalom creating such an upset and David leaving the city of Jerusalem and Shimei throwing rocks at him and cursing him. Look, if you will, back in the text over in chapter 16. Chapter 16. It tells us, beginning in verse 5, "When King David came to Bahurim, behold, there came out thence a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. He came out and cursed still as he came, and he cast stones at David, and all the servants of King David, and all the people, and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. And thus said Shimei when he cursed, 'Begone, begone, thou man of blood, a base fellow. Jehovah hath returned upon thee all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose stead thou hast reigned. And Jehovah hath delivered the kingdom into the hand of Absalom thy son, and behold, thou art taken into thine own mischief, because thou art a man of blood.'" Now Shimei is operating under some serious misconceptions. He thinks that David needs to be cursed, that he needs to be run out of the city of Jerusalem, that he needs no longer be king. And why?
Well, David does.
to his sons when that tragedy had happened, then it would have changed for him.
Well, perhaps so. You mean if he just stomped Absalom in the beginning, we wouldn't have had any problem with this. Well, that's true. We've got some slack in David's response to Absalom. Number one, when he killed Amnon, of course, the relationship there was estranged. Absalom ran away or was sent off, and was gone for a period of time, came back to Jerusalem, was there for a period of time, and David didn't talk to him, and so forth. We're familiar with that. That's all true. But notice, if you will, why is it that Shimei thinks that all this has happened to David?
He says in verse 8, "The Lord has returned upon you all the bloodshed of the house of Saul, and in his place you've reigned. And the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom." Well, David responds by in verse 10 saying, if he curses it, if the Lord has told him to curse David, then who shall say, why have you done so? And then he says, in verse 11, David said to Abishai and to all his servants, "Behold, my son who came out to me, came out from me, seeks my life. How much more this Benjamite? Let him alone and let him curse, for the Lord has told him." David's convinced that this man has been told by God about his sin.
All right.
To Bathsheba.
Had he?
Not that we know of.
Not that we know of, but that's Shimei's argument. This is happening to you because that's what you deserve.
Because he was a man of bloodshed.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, but that's his argument. Now, let's go back to our text over here in chapter 19. Chapter 19. Shimei, when David is being brought back, comes to meet him. And in verse 17, it says, "There were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, and Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons and 20 servants with him. And they went through the Jordan in the presence of the king. And there went over a ferry boat to bring over the king's household and to do what he thought good. And Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king when he was come over the Jordan. And he said unto the king, Let not my lord impute iniquity unto me, neither do thou remember that which thy servant did perversely, the day that my lord the king went out of Jerusalem, that the king should take it to his heart. For thy servant doth know that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I am come this day, the first of all the house of Joseph, to go down to meet my lord the king." Now, Shimei's explanation of this is, "I thought that you became king unjustly, that you took the kingdom from Saul. And so now Absalom has taken the kingdom from you." That's his argument. "So this is just." Well, no, that was not right. Why did Saul lose the kingdom? Was it because of something David did unjustly? Or is it because of Saul's sin? That's right. That's right. Now, why has all this happened to David? Is it because David has done something unjust in his relationship with the house of Saul? Elaborate.
He disobeyed God.
All right, David has taken another man's wife. This has happened to David because of David's sin, not because of him becoming king instead of Saul. Now, that's the false premise that Shimei was operating under. And so when he returns to Saul, or to David rather, he said, "I know that what I did was wrong. Cursing you and accusing you of all those things, that was not to be done." Now, Abishai, the son of Zipporah, what does he want to do to Shimei? Well, kill him. Kill him. A lot of folks want to kill folks. They want to kill him. Well, look, if you will, at verse 22. It says, "And David said, What have I to do with you, ye sons of Zeruiah?"
That was your best pronunciation.
Zeruiah?
Yes.
Well, I'll try. "That ye should do, or this day be adversaries unto me. There shall, or shall there any man be put to death this day in Israel? For do not I know that I am this day king over Israel?" Shimei was not to be killed. Now, question. Why doesn't David kill him? Well, yes, and there's nothing to be proven. Yes.
But God didn't give him the order to do that.
That's correct. That's correct. David doesn't have to prove it.
He was a strong person in the first place.
All right.
Other than his obedience to God, he did what God told him to do. But of his own initiative, the only thing that he did was sin with Bathsheba. He had the opportunity to take into his own order the retribution against his daughter when his son raped her. So then he let somebody else do it instead of him being the man that did it. He was the father.
Yeah.
So and it continues on. Instead of him taking care of Absalom in whatever manner it should have been taken care of, he ignored it. He didn't do it. So
that's
it
right.
Continues on that he's a man after God's own heart, but of his own initiative, he can only do one thing, which was sin with a woman.
Okay.
So his character is kind of shabby, not as strong as it could be, but he's obedient in a certain sense.
All right. Very good. Now what we learn. And all of this, that's not to be gained by killing Shimei. David said, I know that I'm king. So I don't have to kill him to prove that. I know that I'm the king. And the king swore unto him, and all was good. Now, Mephibosheth, remind me, who's Mephibosheth?
One of Saul's sons.
Pardon me?
One of Saul's sons.
Saul's grandson.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jonathan's son. That's right. Mephibosheth. What's the problem with Mephibosheth? He has a problem. He's crippled. That's right. Who was it told me that he was dropped on his head? No, don't quote me. I don't think that's the case.
Okay, so he back up a little
speed,
bit.
Yeah.
I say David, we don't normally think of him as a murderer, but in fact he did commit murder.
He did. Yes. All right. True. Very true.
I wanted to comment on that too. I just two things. One is that Abishai. He's the same Abishai that back in chapter 16 said, "Let me cut off his head."
Yeah.
Now he says, "Yeah, let me kill him again."
Yeah.
He's anxious to kill him, and it seems like in chapter 16, David doesn't have him killed. Because he realizes that there's some truth in what he's saying.
All right.
Now he's not having him killed because he's forgiving him.
Oh, well, that's true.
Because David has been forgiven his murder.
That's true.
And he has compassion on this man.
He does. Yes. So he makes an agreement with him. He's not going to kill him. Now, Mephibosheth. What's happened to Mephibosheth in all this time?
He didn't know.
Ah.
And David didn't know that.
What had his servant said?
The servant said that David didn't want him to go, and the servant told David that he couldn't go. And then when they came back, and David asked him why he didn't go, that's when he found out his servant had lied. Mm-hmm. And had basically told him that David didn't want him to go because it would be too hard for him. And had then basically told David that he couldn't go.
All right. All right. All right. He does, and so the servant has lied, and that's a fact. So what does David want to do to resolve this thing?
Well, he uses his kingly power to say, whatever, you guys take care of it.
Okay. Well, he said to Mephibosheth, you and Ziba divide the land. And Mephibosheth says, no, let him have it. You know, if that's what he wants, then let him have it. And so there was peace. I've not heard it characterized just like that.
Yeah, but he doesn't want to either lose his head.
Yeah, but he didn't. In verse 31 through the next several verses, verse 39, it is, Barzillai was an old man. How old is he? What's his relationship to David? Good friend. Good friend. Old friend. Yes. What is it that he wants to do with David? Or rather, I should say, what is it that David suggests he do, that they do together?
Go to Jerusalem.
Go to Jerusalem. And Barzillai says, no, I can't do that. Why not?
He just wants to die at home.
I'm too old. I want to go home. Yeah, die at home. thy home. But I have a servant over here. What's his name? Shimham. So we're going to take him instead. Let my servant go instead. So that's what he did. Now, look at verse 40. It says, so the king went over to Gilgal. Remember your geography. Where is Gilgal?
Where they originally crossed the river.
Where they originally crossed. Go back to Joshua chapter 3, chapter 4. What existed in Gilgal?
Nothing.
Nothing? Perhaps I should reword the question. What had existed in Gilgal?
Oh, the memorial.
Ah.
Stones.
Yeah. This was an important place. You'll notice the mention of the ferry coming over the Jordan. Gilgal was an important place where travel, of course, occurred. And this was where, by the way, Saul had been appointed to be king. It was where that Joshua had led the people across. It was where Joshua's encampment was during the time of the conquest of the lands, where this pillar, as Richard pointed out, had been erected. It was where people would travel frequently, and children and grandchildren would ask their parents and grandparents about what means this pillar of stones there in Joshua chapter 4, verse 20. And so there's a whole lot of history surrounding this place, Gilgal. So when David crosses back over the Jordan, it's at Gilgal that he crosses. Now, we've already read and discussed verse 41 and following regarding the relationship between those of Judah and those of Israel. Chapter 20, we've got another problem. It says there happened to be there a base fellow whose name was Sheba. Tell me about Sheba, Jenny. Who was Sheba? What did he do?
He decided that he didn't like David and he wanted to be king instead. So he tried to rally all the people to him instead of David.
All right, and the danger of this is that if you let this thing go, it's going to be worse than it was with Absalom. You see in verse 4 and the next few verses. Well, we've got a fellow that David seems to recognize as a fellow of great importance, Amasa. And he somewhat becomes the equivalent, I guess would be an appropriate word, of a captain in David's army. And David calls these fellows together in verse 6. It says, and David said to Abishai, now will Sheba, the son of Bichri, do us more harm than did Absalom. Take thou thy Lord's servant and pursue after him, lest he get him fortified cities and escape out of our sight. Now, we've got Amasa, and we've got David's longtime captain, Joab. What's their relationship?
David tells Amasa that he's going to give Joab the job to him.
All right. That don't go so good, does it? How's Joab feel about that?
I don't know what it says here.
Uh-huh. What's it say here?
It doesn't say anything.
Well, I think it kind of suggests some things. Look, if you will, at verse 8. It says, and they were at the great stone, which is in Gibeon. Amasa came to meet them, and Joab was girded with his apparel of war that he had put on, and thereon was a girdle with a sword fastened upon his loins, and the sheath thereof. And as he went forth, it fell out. And Joab said to Amasa, is it well with thee, my brother? And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. But Amasa took no heed to the sword that was in Joab's hand. So he smote him therewith in the body and shed out his bowels to the ground and struck him not again, and he died.
There was that.
I don't think Joab was too happy with Amasa. It seems that they're somewhat rivals, and the idea of Amasa being appointed to take Joab's job didn't didn't set too well. You'll notice that Joab and Abishai, Abishai's brother, pursued after Sheba, the son of Beri, and there stood by him one of Joab's young men, he that favoreth Joab, and he that is for David, let him follow Joab. And Amasa lay wallowing in his blood in the midst of the highway. There was that too. That kind of slowed things down, so they had to move him out of the road so the army could move on. And when they come to the city where Sheba was, we're introduced to a wise woman in verse 16. Now this wise woman, she meets the army of David, as it were, and she has a very interesting question. What is her question?
Why do you want to destroy us?
Yeah, well, we got this problem with Sheba. And if you will give us Sheba, then we won't have any quarrel with the city. So, just a very loose paraphrase, her response is, wait just a minute. And she went back into the city, and then what happened? All right, the head of Sheba came flying over the fence. And so they get their army together and go back to where they came from. Now, that's the essence of chapter 20. The trumpet is blown in verse 22, which is a signal that the war is over. And so they return to Jerusalem unto the king. Now, in verse 1 of chapter 21, there is a famine in the days of David that lasts for 3 years, year after year. And David sought the face of Jehovah. Interestingly enough, in the latter part of verse 1, it tells us, and Jehovah said, it is for Saul and for his bloody house, because he put to death the Gibeonites. Now, if my understanding is correct, and some of you, if you would like to correct me on this, I would appreciate it. I've looked. I don't find any record of Saul killing the Gibeonites. If that's recorded, I've just missed it somewhere. But it's stated here as a fact, as the cause of this famine that has come upon the land. It says, now the Gibeonites were not of the children of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites, and the children of Israel had sworn unto them. Now, that we do have a record of. That goes back to Joshua chapter 9. What is it that the Gibeonites have done? Now, notice again your geography. Where is it that the Gibeonites have come from during the days of Joshua? That's the people, yes. And so what we find is that these folks have put on clothes that are all worn out and their food is all moldy. And they said that we've come from a long, long way off and we've heard about the things that you've done and we don't want to be destroyed and so we want you to make a covenant with us. Problem, what were the people of Israel to do about making covenants with folks that lived in the land? You're not supposed to make any covenants, you're supposed to destroy them. But because you're from a long way off and you've suffered the consequences of your journey and so forth, what was it that was done with the Gibeonites? Pardon me? All right, so a covenant was made with them. Well, then they find out they're not from a far country, they've lied. But what about the covenant that's been made? Was it to be honored? Yes, it was to be honored. Now, the evidence here is that Saul, at least at one point, had not honored it. And so now we have a famine that's come upon the people of Israel and the people of Judah because Saul had not honored this covenant. Now, in the text of chapter 21, David said to the Gibeonites, what shall I do for you?
Why did they maintain the allegiance of the covenant? Why didn't they take a position once they found out they had been deceived that they were really not a people? Why didn't they say, hey, you just nullified the covenant because you kind of lied to us? I'm not sure I understand why they felt obligated to continue to honor the covenant.
I'm not sure I have an explanation that would be satisfactory. We do know that when we make a vow, we're to be faithful to the vows that we make. These people had made a covenant, a vow, if you please.
But under false pretenses.
It was under false pretenses, and we know that as a result of the vow that had been taken, or a covenant that had been entered into, Joshua and those of his army had defended the Gibeonites against some who would have attacked them. We see that record back over in the book of Joshua. Now, it was to be honored. Why? Again, I don't know, because it was established under false pretenses. Yes.
I think we discussed at that time that one of the reasons was because they did not ask the counsel of God regarding these people.
Yeah. Yeah, now that's true. I remember we did discuss that. That's right. But it was to be honored, and it had not been honored now by Saul, and now here we see consequences and so on. Yeah.
Can we take away from the lesson that you need to honor your word no matter what the other guy did? I mean, it doesn't matter if you didn't have all of the facts.
We need to honor our word, yes. However, we can't honor our word to the extent of engaging in sinful practices. We can't do that. I can't promise to do sinful things and then, well, I promised. That would sure be an out, wouldn't it?
Well, that's what they did here.
Yeah, well, essentially so, but they did spare these people. Yeah.
Well, I think in that, then, God recognized that as a covenant that needed to be kept, because otherwise now there's problems later on down the road.
Yeah.
Because that covenant wasn't kept, even though it was against what God said in the beginning.
Yeah.
That covenant is something that God recognizes that was supposed to be taken care of. So even though it's sinned against them, he's still saying you need to honor that?
Well, the question is, yes, they had not defeated these people and destroyed them. They had left them in the land. That is true. Contrary to destroying everybody, this is what God had instructed them to do. They had made a covenant. Now they've made that covenant, and they're bound by it. Yes, they're bound by it.
That was just another thing that Saul did by not seeking the counsel of God.
Yes. Yes. Very good. Yeah, they're bound by it. Now, how do we satisfy the Gibeonites?
He wants the seven sons of Saul.
All right.
We want the seven sons of Saul.
We want the seven sons of Saul.
I don't really understand this chapter.
Well, there's a lot in this chapter. Specifically what?
Well, this first part, the revenge, you know, God taking vengeance on Saul. Saul's dead. I don't see justice done by hanging his sons.
Ah. Let's go back. What was it that God had said to Saul because of his rebellion? Yeah. I won't leave any of your descendants to sit on the throne. Let's go back to 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel chapter 15. Verse 28. Beginning, I guess. It says, "And Samuel said unto him, Jehovah hath rent the kingdom of Israel from thee this day, and hath given it to a neighbor of thine that is better than thou. And also the strength of Israel will not lie nor repent, for he is not a man that should repent. Then he said, I have sinned, yet honor me now." And these, of course, this lists or suggests to us the request of Saul for Samuel to return with him. Let me go back one more time here to chapter 13, verse 13. Chapter 13, verse 13. It says, "And Samuel said to Saul, Thou hast done foolishly. thou hast not kept the commandment of Jehovah thy God, which he commanded thee. For now would Jehovah have established thy kingdom upon Israel forever, but now thy kingdom shall not continue. Jehovah has sought him a man after his own heart. And of course the reason is because thou hast not kept that which Jehovah commanded thee. So we know that the kingdom was removed from him, but your question has to do with why seek vengeance then upon the sons of Saul. I had a thought on that. Let me see if I can put it together.
Well, the sons of Saul, as far as we know, didn't try and take the kingdom from David.
No, they did not.
They accepted.
We know that Saul's chief captain, what was his name, Abner, sought to appoint Ishbosheth to be king. Of course, he's already been killed, contrary to David's wishes, by Joab. Well, I may have to think some more on that to complete my thoughts. We know that Saul's sons, all but Mephibosheth, his grandson, the son of Jonathan, are delivered. The two sons of verse 8, Rizpah, the daughter of Ai, she bare unto Saul, and the names are given. The five sons of Michal, the daughter of Saul, and of course the names are given. He delivered them, and they were hanged by the Gibeonites before Jehovah. And then, of course, they are satisfied.
It'd be nice to know the other side of the story that's missing.
Yeah, I'm going to have to think some more on that, Randy, and we'll have to discuss that, I guess, at another time.
No wrench.
It's a good question. In the remaining few verses of chapter 21, we see again and again David's battles with the Philistines. We've mentioned earlier that he drove them back to the portion of land where they dwelt, but they don't just cease to exist. It says in verse 15 that the Philistines had war again with Israel, and David went down and his servants with him and fought against the Philistines. And then in verse 18, it came to pass after this that there was again war with the Philistines at Gob. And then in verse 19, there was again war with the Philistines at Gob, and Elhanah, the son of, and it names these characters, you can pronounce them if you like. In verse 20, there was again war at Gath, and there we're introduced to the fellow that had six fingers and six toes on each hand and foot. And then in verse 22, these four were born to the giant in Gath, and they fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. We'll start with that next time, Randy, and see if we can't get a better picture of the answer to your thoughts.